Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Norman Mueller. I represent Mr. Gabler. I first want to talk about the violation of the explicit prosecutorial promise not to file habitual criminal charges in return for Mr. Gabler's waiver of his right to preliminary hearing in what I'm going to call case number one. I seem to have trouble remembering numbers these days, so I'm going to talk about case number one and case number two. In case number one, and I want to take the court through the sequence of events in that case procedurally, and these appear in the register of actions and in the minute orders, both of which appear in volume one. Mr. Gabler was charged by information and complaint on April 22nd. You will note if you look at the complaint information that the requested bond was $10,000, but the magistrate ordered that there would be a no bond hold until Mr. Gabler appeared before the court. He was arrested. He came in to court for his advisement hearing on May 11th. The minute orders reflect, the register of actions reflect, he was in custody without counsel. So it was set over for 2 days. The public defender was appointed. He appears on May 13th, 2 days later, with the public defender, again, in custody. On May 11th, according to the Register of Actions, in that initial hearing, when he was advised of the charges, bond was set at $10,000. He is still in custody 2 days later on May 13th. The case is then set over, still represented by at that time represented by the public defender, until June 3rd. What was the purpose of the June 3rd hearing? To have the preliminary hearing and for potential bond reduction motions. When Mr. Gabler appears on June 3rd, he is still represented by the public defenders and he is still in custody. In this case, bond has not been posted. Even though he was charged with Class 5 felonies at that time, he was entitled to a preliminary hearing under both the statute and the rules because he was in custody in this case. And he waived his preliminary hearing in return for the explicit promise by the district attorney that the habitual criminal charges would not be filed. That is the violation. The prosecutor later violated that promise, that agreement, because as you know from the complicated procedural history of the case, a subsequent case is filed in Adams County. And I think it's important if you compare what happened in these two cases, because Mr. Gabler also waived his preliminary hearing in case number two. But what was his waiver for? It was in return for an offer, a plea dispositional offer. He was offered the ability to plead guilty to count two in case number two, admitting that it was a case of domestic violence, in return for the prosecution not pursuing the habitual criminal charges that were already filed in case number two.
Mr. Mueller,
yes,
was this argument preserved below?
Well, I believe it was. As we detailed, I think, in our reply brief, Your Honor, what happened was Mr. Gabler lost the public defender's office. There was an undisclosed public conflict of interest. Alternative defense counsel was appointed, and it's not at all clear. Alternate defense counsel was not present, was not counsel of record when the waiver occurred. Alternate defense counsel did not raise this particular issue. When Mr. Vance, the alternate defense counsel's counsel, he negotiated the waiver of the preliminary hearing in case number two, but that was basically to waive the preliminary hearing in return for a promise, a plea offer, which was never accepted, ultimately not accepted by Mr. Gabler. That's why we're not raising any issue with regard to the habitual criminal counts in case number two. So this issue was not presented until Mr. Gabler, and remember, this is a client with significant mental health issues who raised competency issues, who imposed a not guilty by reason of insanity plea. It was not raised until after the conviction when Mr. Gabler filed a fairly rambling pro se motion for new trial, basically saying, what about this promise that that I was made back 2 years ago? So we think that is sufficient because Judge Murphy stated, I've reviewed the pro se motion, I've considered it, and I deny it. Now, there's no explicit findings other than that denial. We think that's sufficient to preserve it. But even if you consider this under plain error standard, this is a plain error. This is an explicit promise made by the prosecution. This is a violation of due process. And that's why we submit that the habitual criminal charges have to be dismissed and new sentences have to be imposed in case number one. The primary argument that the state has made to us is that he wasn't entitled to a preliminary hearing because he had these other charges pending and may physically have been present in the Boulder County Jail. But what's clear from the record is that the bond in this case, $10,000, set on May 11th when he first appeared for the for the advisement hearing, was not posted until August 14th. So at the time of the request for preliminary hearing, at the time of the waiver for preliminary hearing, Mr. Gabler was in custody in this case.
Pardon me for interrupting, Mr. Mueller, if I may, please. I'd like to ask you two questions. First, the record, as I read it, is pretty clear that counsel at the habitual criminal hearing in case number one did not raise the issue that you're talking about now. Is that right?
Not.
And then number two, in looking at the document to which you're referring in case number one, can't that be read as also this is a plea disposition offer, that in exchange for waiving the preliminary hearing, the prosecution would consider a plea disposition in which it would not file habitual criminal counts?
No.
Why not?
Because it's explicit. It says the prosecution will not file habitual criminal charges. That is the consideration that Mr. Gabler gave. I'm going to waive this preliminary hearing. And that's why I raised the waiver of the preliminary hearing in case number two, Judge Bernard, because that's precisely what you're talking about. We know that often preliminary hearings are waived in criminal cases when they're in order to keep an offer open or in exchange for that offer being made. But in this case, it was explicitly stated, we will not file these habitual criminal charges. What did Mr. Gabler give up? He gave up his right to a preliminary hearing. And the right to preliminary hearing attaches to the case. It doesn't attach to where the defendant is in jail. Just because there are concurrent cases, or physically Mr. Gabler may be in Boulder Jail or in the Adams County Jail, that doesn't matter as to the right to a preliminary hearing.
Is there any other evidence in the record besides the document?
No.
That to which you're referring? It's just a document.
It's the document.
All right, thank you.
Judge Berger.
Plain error has been defined as an error that is so clear cut, so obvious, that a competent trial judge should be able to avoid it without the benefit of an objection. Does this error meet that standard?
It means it for two reasons, Your Honor. It's in the court file, and as a practical matter, we know that this case was bounced around from judge to judge. That happens. It was bounced around from county court to county court, from magistrate to county court. But this is an explicit waiver of an explicit agreement by the prosecution not to file these charges. So I submit, number one, that when you have that in the court file, that's sufficient. But more importantly, in this case, whatever the standard, because Mr. Gabler brought this to the attention before sentencing, brought the trial court's attention to this before sentencing, whatever the standard, whether it be plain or whether it be just the normal review that the court would impose. And it's a de novo interpretation of what the plea agreement, you know, what a plea agreement or what a promise means. And because this rises to the level of due process considerations, because that's why courts need to enforce prosecutorial promises, is because it's a matter of due process of law. So For those two reasons separately, Your Honor, I think it meets the standard. But we don't have to rely just on the document itself. We have Mr. Gabler bringing the court's attention to this issue.
What if the document is ambiguous? Isn't the better way to resolve this issue at a post-conviction proceeding?
I don't think the document is ambiguous. I find nothing ambiguous about
I understand that's your position, but what if we were to conclude that it's ambiguous?
Well, Your Honor, I'm worried about... I can always tell you what... the district attorney's office is going to say, well, you raised this in the Court of Appeals, and you cannot now raise it in a 35C. This is not like a Curtis issue where we have direction from the Supreme Court that, yes, you can only raise it now in a 35C proceeding. So I don't think there's, because I don't think there's any ambiguity here, and because I think this was an explicit promise that needs to be enforced, the remedy should be not to require resentencing on those two counts, stalking and eluding, were the two counts in case number one that were both enhanced by habitual criminal charges. I'm going to reserve a couple minutes, but let me quickly jump to the instructional issue regarding intimidation of a witness in case number two. Everybody conceded that that statute is poorly written, and the problem we have with the trial court's denial of the defense tendered instruction, and Judge Berger, we don't have any preservation issues on this particular issue because a tendered instruction was given by Mr. Vance and was rejected by the trial court, is that there was no tying of the injury. The jury did not have to find that there was a nexus between the harm. And in this case, it was because of the intimidation. It was basically the threats, the annoyance, the harassment over the phone, which related to the second stalking charges, and the intent to influence the witness's testimony. And it was prejudicial in this case because I think the record, I debated whether I should have even raised a sufficiency claim on this because it was pretty clear from the record that the so-called harassment and annoyance from the phone calls in the second case related not to keep her from testifying, not to influence her testimony, not to get her not to appear, but related to why aren't you letting me have contact with my son. So there were, because the jury could have, and probably did in my opinion, could find that what might have just been harassment, what might have just been a threat, was elevated to a class 4 felony without the finding that that was done with the intent to influence testimony. And that's the problem without requiring that nexus between the harm to the accuser, the harm to the alleged victim, and having it being tied to that future testimony.
Are you arguing that the statute as written is irrational?
No, I'm arguing that intent requirement is a part of, based on the case law that we've cited, that the intent of the intimidation and retaliation statutory scheme requires that nexus to the testimony. And just like in Hickman, when the legislature had eliminated the intent requirement from the retaliation statute, the Supreme Court said, we're still going to infer that intent. And that's what we're asking the court to do here. There has to be that inference of intent. And that's why our proposed statute would have cured what we say is a claim is an error.
Pardon me, Mr. Mueller, but as I look at the statute, it seems to have a fact that you don't have in every harassment case that the prosecution must prove, because the defendant must believe that the person whom he or she inflicts harm or injury on is about to be called to testify as a witness or a victim. Right?
That is in the statute.
So that's an additional thing beyond the standard harassment case, right?
But the problem is that it creates It makes a threat or harassment of someone who holds that status as a victim or a witness subject to a Class 4 felony, even though that threat or that harassment or that harm or that annoyance was not done with any intent to affect the testimony. And that's what I say is required.
But I understand what you're saying, but isn't that a legislative judgment? Can't the legislature say that for this status of person, because this person is critical to the fact-finding process, the judicial process, that we're going to turn these particular harassments into a Class 4 felony?
In as a direct answer, yes, the legislature obviously has power to enact those statutes. The problem is the legislature did this in the intimidation statute, in the retaliation statute, by requiring a nexus that there be this intent, that the annoyance, that the harm be directed to influencing the testimony or punishing somebody for testimony. So if I go to get in a bar fight with somebody who I happen to know is a victim or witness, but had my fight has nothing to do with it, I should not be charged with intimidating a witness or retaliating against a witness unless that fight had something to do with it. And I'm past my time.
Thank you, Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the court. Kevin McReynolds, Colorado Bar Number 40978, on behalf of the people. I'd like to start with the same issue Mr. Mueller started with. The issue regarding the motion for new trial alleging prosecutorial misconduct that has been transformed now into a appellate claim requesting specific enforcement of a prosecutorial promise regarding waiver of preliminary injunction. Now, Mr. Mueller has focused on the issue of detrimental reliance in his briefing and has not addressed what I think is sort of the bigger point here, which is the case Pena that came out shortly before the prosecutor moved to amend and add the habitual charges here. And Pena is fairly controlling here because defendant essentially concedes that if he was not in custody at the time that he made this preliminary hearing waiver, that he was not entitled to a preliminary hearing. That's what the statute says. And that preliminary hearing statute was examined in Pena in exactly the scenario we have here. In Pena, the individual was in a different jurisdiction, held on different charges, and was then transferred to, I think it was El Paso County, on a writ of habeas corpus ad, and I never pronounced this right, prosecutorium, to face those charges, to make his request for preliminary hearing. And in that scenario, reading the statutes that relate to specifically whether you are in custody for the purposes of having a right to preliminary injunction for a Class 5 felony, the Pena case held that he was in the custody of Pueblo County, where he was held, and having been writted down for the other charges, did not create custody in that other jurisdiction. He was not in custody for such charge. He was not in custody for those charges. And that's exactly what happened here. Mr. Gabler was in custody in Boulder for his pre-existing charge. He was written down to Adams County to face the new charges. Case one was case 09-CR-1158. He was written down for that when he waived his preliminary hearing. He didn't have a right to a preliminary hearing at that time. And the cases that the defense is focused on, McRander, sets forth essentially there are two conditions that will sort of need to be met in order for specific enforcement of a preliminary hearing waiver to be the necessary remedy.
Can you be in the custody of two different jurisdictions simultaneously?
According to the Pena case, you cannot, as far as the preliminary hearing statute is concerned. And that hasn't been addressed at all by defendant's briefing as to why this case, why Pena is wrong, or why it's statutory interpretation regarding what custody means for the purposes of this preliminary hearing statute. And to the extent that this is on plain error review, because this was not raised until after not only the trial was complete, but they had the motions hearing on the defendant's longstanding, the actual objections his lawyer did make to habitual charges in 1158 after that had been denied. And on plain error review, I don't think that this court can say that, well, it was, number one, Pena is legally wrong, it was plain error that it was legally wrong, that we must equate his custody in Boulder County to his custody in 1158, even though he was only appeared on a writ.
Mr. McReynolds, is his belief that he was entitled to a preliminary hearing and the prosecutor's belief that he was entitled to a preliminary hearing, is that enough to secure an absolute, explicit promise by the prosecutor?
I don't know what the prosecutor's subjective belief was. Clearly, we know what Mr. Gabler believes his was. But it's a legal question. Pena made it clear that it's a legal question of whether or not you have a right to a preliminary hearing is a question of law.
Well, I'm assuming the prosecutor believed it, because otherwise the prosecutor would make a fraudulent representation to him.
Yeah, I have no idea, Your Honor. But I even if they both believed it and both had this mistaken belief, it's a question of law. It's similar to in civil contracts, if there is no consideration, even if they believed there was, if there is no consideration, the contract is void ab initio. It never formed. There was no agreement. But turning back to McRander, the sort of the due process clause, the two conditions, one, the defendant there had a right to a preliminary hearing. That doesn't exist here. And the second condition being that he suffered an actual loss of liberty based on the waiver of his preliminary hearing. And that didn't happen here either. And a case that's pretty helpful for that is People v. Frazier at 895 P. Second, 1077. Came to the same conclusion 20 years ago where it was a similar context. The defendant was in custody for a murder conviction and had an issue with a waiver of preliminary injunction, preliminary hearing. I keep doing that. And the court concluded, the defendant suffered no loss of liberty prior to trial attributable to the proposed agreements to waive the preliminary hearing because he was already in custody for a separate and independent charge. That's what happened here. He was in custody for a separate and independent charge. His waiver of the preliminary hearing did not serve the primary purpose of the preliminary hearings, which is, in this scenario, which is to ensure the swift release where no probable cause exists. There would have been no release.
Pardon me, Mr. McReynolds. I'd like to test your assertion that he was in custody on a different charge. He, of course, was in Boulder, and these weren't Boulder cases. But Mr. Mueller has indicated that the reason that he remained in custody in Boulder was the $10,000 bond that had been imposed in case number one, the first Adams County case. If that is so, even if he's in a separate jail, if he's there because of that bond in case one, doesn't that undercut your argument?
It would if that were accurate, Your Honor. He was on a parole hold in the Boulder County Court, and his parole hearing officer actually testified and provided some more information about that, albeit unknowingly, because we didn't know that this issue was going to come up at the time. But during the habitual motions, there was some discussion of the fact that he was held and would not be released from Boulder Jail through August. And this waiver took place in June. Focusing on the time period at which the waiver was taking place, even if that bond had not existed in case 1158, he would have still been held in Boulder through August. So I don't believe that it does undercut the argument. And again, I think that in order for this court to reverse, it would have to find on plain error review, one, that Pena is legally incorrect and that he did in fact have a right to preliminary injunction, and two, that because despite being held on the separate charge in Boulder, that he in fact suffered an actual loss of his pretrial liberty, And there's nothing to find such a, make such a finding on plain error.
Is Pena a decision of the Colorado Supreme Court or of this court?
It's of this court, and it was issued in September 2009, shortly before the amendment that added the habitual charges to case 1158 here.
So we're not bound by Pena.
You're not bound by it. I would submit that defense counsel has not argued against Pena. He has instead relied solely on the decision McGrander, which is inapplicable here, even if there was a right to preliminary injunction, for the same reason that it was inapplicable in Frazier. If there are no further questions on that issue, I'll move on to the witness intimidation statute. The statute states exactly what it states. It states four different methods by which one can commit witness intimidation, which is threatening, harassing, harming a person who is known to be a witness or a victim of a crime. And there is specific nexus language in all four parts, albeit somewhat different in Part 4 as opposed to, not Part 4, in Part D as opposed to A through C. It requires, you know, causing harm, intentionally attempts to or does inflict harm or injury before the expected testimony. In other words, it's in situations like we have here where Mr. Gabler specifically went after this victim, and factually in phone calls between August 14th and August 16th, threatened to kill the victim, made threats about killing her boyfriend at the time, Mr. Birch, who was also a witness who would have been called in the first case. And that's in the testimony from 4/12/2011 at pages 80 to 88. Those are actual threats against threatening to kill a known witness, an actual victim. That is sufficient under the statute the way it is written. Mr. Mueller would like us very much to add new language to the statute that is not ambiguous, that states in unambiguous terms what the statute requires. And there was no debate during the jury instruction hearing that the instruction given tracked the language of the statute. Personal opinions that attorneys may have had about whether it was badly written or not doesn't make it ambiguous. The language of the statute is unambiguous, and it should be enforced, and the legislature's language should be respected.
Mr. McReynolds, hasn't the case law pretty much clarified that the statute is interpreted so as to require a showing of intent to influence testimony?
I don't recall seeing that specifically. I think that you could, the way the statute is written, it certainly infers that there is an intent to inflict harm with a witness who's going to testify.
Assuming that,
yes.
What added burden was placed upon the prosecutor by the defendant's proposed instruction?
It would have added an additional specific element that is not in the statute, that is not required by the statute, that the General Assembly did not make an element of that crime. It would, I think that in practical terms, how it would have played out in trial, it would not have changed the result because of the type of, the level of evidence we had, the types of threats that were being made, the angry statements from Mr. Gabler that he was going to, that he was upset, he was going to get them back for getting him into trouble. Those types of statements, or making trouble for him, those types of statements would have been sufficient. That's why if this court were to find somehow that the plain language of the statute is ambiguous and that we should have added that additional nexus element that is not in Part D, it was a harmless error. And it was a harmless error because if you look at the testimony and you look at the trial record as a whole, there was sufficient evidence to believe that the jury would have made that inference, that natural inference, that if you're threatening to kill somebody and making comments about I'm going to get you back for or I'm going to get you for getting me in trouble, those types of comments directed at a known victim who's a witness in a case was sufficient for the jury to make that inference.
Pardon me for interrupting.
Yes.
Mr. Mueller raises the hypothetical of a person in a bar fight who happens to know that someone's going to be a witness, but the purpose behind the fight has nothing to do with the coming testimony. How do you respond to that hypothetical case?
That hypothetical case, obviously very different than the scenario. I'm not sure whether or not that would be necessarily covered in D, because in that particular circumstance, if he knows that it's a witness and he, for example, in that bar fight, picks to have his fight with that person or picks that person as who he's going to hit with a bottle, that could suggest that he targeted them, that he intentionally inflicted harm on them before their testimony, knowing that they're a witness, especially if they're a witness against him, as happened here. I think that would be sufficient to charge and to convict under the witness intimidation statute, because there would be facts from which you could make that conclusion.
Mr. McReynolds, you don't have too much time, but I want to go back and ask you the same question I asked Mr. Mueller. Assuming we find that the defendant was in custody and therefore was entitled to a preliminary hearing, how do you analyze the question of whether or not there was plain error in not enforcing the promise?
I think we would have to look to the key issue there would be whether or not his liberty was in fact impinged upon at the time that he made that waiver. And because there were independent bases for holding him at that time, there was no error, and it could not be fundamental
error.
No,
but assuming we rule against you on that,
okay,
and we say he was in custody in that case,
mm-hmm,
and there is a preservation issue here, and assuming we find that it wasn't preserved, the error was not preserved, how do you analyze whether or not there was plain error in not enforcing the promise?
So I think I'm still stumbling over, I think, the distinction between the whether he was in custody and had a right is one issue. The completely separate issue is whether that custody actually impacted his freedom of liberty at that time, June 2009, and it did not, because he was held for another thing also. Because he was held for another thing also, there was no impingement on his liberty. There was no, essentially, due process harm to him by not enforcing that promise. We ask you affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McReynolds. Thank you again, Mr. Mueller. We greatly appreciate counsel's preparation and excellent arguments today. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.